On this week's 51%, a psychologist helps manage stress amid the COVID-19 crisis.
Again, this is just such a situation where we're all needing to balance caring for ourselves with caring for everybody around us, that it makes it particularly complex.
A singer-songwriter shares her addiction problems.
Since I wasn't in college anymore, so I just started to drink like it was my day job.
And music interprets sea level rise. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. The Institute for Disaster Mental Health at the State University of New York at New Paltz has put out a psychological first aid and stress management toolkit. The strategies are to help faculty, staff, students, and others during the COVID-19 pandemic. I spoke with the director of the Institute, Dr. Amy Nitza. She says the toolkit, which appears as a 60-page PowerPoint presentation, is also in Spanish, with other languages to come. Just a warning that some listeners may find the discussion at the end of this interview about dying alone upsetting.
We've distributed it via all of our networks, but it's kind of taken on a life of its own. Through Facebook, we've seen it. We've seen other people sharing it that are not people that we are usually connected to. So I think people have just found it to be something that's really accessible and goes beyond a list of bullet points that say things like, make sure that you're getting enough sleep and things like that. Those are all true things, but I think this goes a little bit deeper into how to manage your stress.
Could you give one or two examples about some of, I mean, I'm sure they're all useful, but maybe some feedback you're getting, whether on campus or not, about one or two that are extraordinarily helpful and can be put to use right away?
Sure. So they sort of go in an order, but I think the most important one is to figure out, and the first step really is to figure out specifically what it is that's causing you stress at any particular moment. So this situation can really be overwhelming and just feel like a big cloud of stress and anxiety. And so slowing down and teasing that apart and figuring out what it is specifically that's causing you the most distress at any given time, maybe breaking it down into a list of smaller stresses instead of one big ball of stress is the first step. And then being able to tackle each of the things on the list by just, first of all, deciding, are each of these things that I do have some control over or things that I don't have control over? And so there are pieces of this that, unfortunately, we all just have to accept as things that are outside of our control. And then there are other pieces of this that we do have some control over, even if they aren't the choices that we would normally choose to make. The rest of them just sort of build on that, right? So the things that we don't have control over, we can still develop and make a plan for a set of coping strategies around it. So if there are pieces of this that you know you're just going to have to tolerate and get through, what can you do to regulate your emotions when those things get particularly stressful? This is where things like mindfulness or deep breathing exercises or, you know, stretching, relaxation, things like that come in to help you regulate your own emotions when you can't control what's happening on the outside.
Sure. And I think that partially what we're seeing with yoga studios, Pilates studios, workout spaces, meditation spaces are all offering, you know, something online, a lot of them free because they recognize the necessity for this among such a broad range of people.
Exactly.
How are you seeing this affect the New Paltz campus? I know everyone's pretty much off campus, but how are you seeing this affect?
Yeah. So we offered, Carla Vermeulen and I offered a training for the Campus Administrative Council, which is a big group of people in administrative positions. And really, this is a situation where now we are all sort of needing to be more actively focused on caring for ourselves and caring for others in a way that emotionally, I guess I should say, in a way that we aren't always directly focused on. And so, you know, from faculty members needing to maybe spend more time checking on students and making sure that they're doing okay before they launch right into the lesson, to administrators needing to check on their teams, their staff, and make sure that their staff are, or find out how their staff are coping and leading in a different way than they typically do. And so offering them tools for things like being able to listen effectively and respond effectively to other people's distress, and just being able to sit and, yeah, hear someone's story and respond effectively at the same time that we're caring for ourselves. Again, this is just such a situation where we're all needing to balance caring for ourselves with caring for everybody around us, that it makes it particularly complex.
You know, I think you spoke to this a bit earlier, but you and I unfortunately tend to speak when there's been a disaster, generally of the natural disaster kind, or, you know, some sort of tragedy, aircraft or a train or something of that nature. How does this differ, this kind of tragedy differ from the others in terms of how people are reacting, the anxiety level, and then you in the field kind of administering that psychological first aid? How does it differ?
Yeah. It differs in a few ways. You know, I think the first one is that for the other kinds of disasters that you just listed, there's usually an end point, a clear end point. And so we know the situation is or the immediate danger is over, and then we can start to recover. And even if the recovery is deeply painful and difficult and long, we know that we're safe and that process can start. One of the things that's, I think it's creating much of the anxiety around this is that we don't know when it's over, and we don't know when or if we're safe. And so the ambiguity and the uncertainty just continues over a long period of time. And that's really hard on us as humans physiologically, to stay in that state of stress over a longer period of time. And we typically say people need to feel safe before, that's the first step in the recovery process. And so in this period where we don't know when we're officially all going to be safe again, it's hard for what we would typically call recovery to start. And then I would say the other big difference is that a lot of disasters are, as big as they might be, they're limited to a certain group or a certain population of people who are the survivors of that, and then there are other people who are the responders. And in this situation, the psychological impact of this disaster is so much bigger than the physical impact, because while the numbers of people who are actually sick are, you know, staggeringly high, the vast majority of us are not physically sick, but yet we're still psychologically impacted. And so the scope of this psychologically is just so much bigger than most other disasters that we typically talk about.
You know, and I'm thinking ahead to being optimistic when there is that day where it's deemed safe. Do we still feel safe, though? Even though those words may be uttered and by someone that we trust, I mean, are people still going to feel comfortable doing what they were?
Well, we know that, you know, one of the biggest antidotes to anxiety is clear and accurate information. And so with so much, you know, different kinds of information and, quite frankly, misinformation floating around, it's really hard for people to know what to grasp onto as the clear and accurate information that can help us make good decisions. And so I do think there's going to be a need to be a sort of a rebuilding process of all of us establishing what safety means and where we get our clear and accurate information from.
Very good point. I also wanted to ask you, because a lot are coping with this, this image, this reality for some of dying alone, the stress of being in the situation of it is your loved one who is dying alone, and the anxiety that that breeds, which is separate and apart or built upon what you've already spoken about. How does one even begin to deal with that?
Yeah, it's a really challenging situation. This is changing the ways that we grieve, or it's going to change, I guess, the ways that we grieve and the ways that we typically have constructed the process of saying goodbye to people and losing people. So I think that we're going to all have to hold on to or create for ourselves new ways to invoke the same meaning around that process in a different way, if that makes any sense. So the way that we would typically hold a funeral, or the way that we would typically all be together to try to say goodbye to someone, what are the, if we can, and I'm not saying this is an easy process, but what is it that is meaningful or important about those rituals or those practices? And are there other ways that we can still establish the same, create the same meaning around those things and get them met in different ways?
Yeah, thank you.
Again, no easy answers, but
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a whole new world, obviously.
Exactly.
Any other messages you want to get out there? Any other advice, comments?
You know, I think one of the things that we know empirically from research is that the best predictor of how well people are going to do after a extremely stressful situation like this is their level of perceived social support. And so the more isolated and alone we feel, the more likely we are to have a negative outcome from a mental health perspective. And so staying connected in whatever ways, again, we might have to get the same needs met in different ways, but what can you do to stay connected, even if it's just to one person, so that even as we're socially distancing, we're still staying socially connected, is really, I think, one of the best pieces of advice that we could offer.
Dr. Amy Nitze is director of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health at the State University of New York at New Paltz. After bursting on the Twin Cities music scene as a teenager, singer-songwriter Lydia Liza got a crash course in growing up. By her early 20s, she struggled with a serious addiction to alcohol. KFAI Sheila Regan spoke with Liza about her process of finding sobriety.
In Minneapolis, Minnesota, I'm Sheila Regan.
I have got it, but I've got it back.
There's a quiet ache to Lydia Liza's voice. It has layers of sadness in its rich tones.
I definitely really value the fact that I am an addict because I feel like I have appreciation for things I never did before.
Liza first started doing music when she was 14, when she learned how to play the guitar. She taught herself most of the Mumford & Sons first album, and got a few friends from junior high to start a band with her called Bomba De Luce. After winning studio time from a Battle of the Bands competition, they made their first record.
And I dropped it off at the Current, and I just wrote a little note, like, whoever does the local show, this is my band. And then they ended up playing us pretty immediately, and then we just ended up gigging all the time.
Liza and her band got really popular really fast. She says that around the same time, she got into a bad relationship with an older guy who drank heavily and began drinking herself to cope.
I started drinking when I was 16. There's a reason it's self-medicating. You know, it works. It takes away a lot of that people don't want to deal with.
Liza was hospitalized for suicidal ideation when she was 19.
It was another, like, realization, like, I'm going to kill myself today. And that's how today's going down, and then it'll all be over. And then I thought, I should probably call my mom. And then I called her, and she came and got me and brought me straight to the hospital.
It wasn't until 4 years later that she'd get treatment for her addiction. Liza had gone viral for the song she co-wrote with Josiah Lemansky, a non-rape culture version of Baby, It's Cold Outside, at the end of 2016.
I really can't stay.
Baby, I'm fine with that.
It was finals week, so I was like, I can't do finals. I haven't been there to learn any of the finals stuff. So I just dropped out. And then it blew over, and then I had all this time since I wasn't in college anymore. So I just started to drink like it was my day job.
A little more than a year later, Liza hit rock bottom when she went inpatient for suicidal ideation for the second time. After she was released from her second hospitalization, Liza spent a month binge drinking before starting a program at Hazleton in March of 2018. It was a day program, and she'd spend time with her family in the evenings.
So I think I spent the first 3 months of sobriety sleeping and crying, and then 4, 5, 6 is when I really started to get involved in going to meetings. And then I also was making sure I was journaling every day. I had to, like, sit down with myself at the end of the day and be like, all right, just write everything you're feeling. Don't stop. Just do it.
Liza also found healing in going for walks.
There's a book called The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, And she talks about how clearing and meditative walking can be.
After 6 months of sobriety, Liza found that she could start writing music again, and some of her journey appears in her music. Her song Gardenia, for instance, speaks to becoming unhinged.
You're a sad man, I've come unhinged.
Another song Liza recorded with Spencer Worth Davis, otherwise known as Big Cats, also touches on alcoholism. It's called Wouldn't Know.
Got off track, had to get my feet wet. I waited till the chain split, filled my glass up.
When you're in active addiction, you do genuinely hate yourself and everything, and this is why you drink. And you have all these crazy thoughts about yourself that when you quit and you start being softer on yourself, that critic is quieter, and then you have more space for experimentation and more space in your brain for trying rather than shutting yourself down immediately. So once my brain critic kind of started to quiet down, then this other creative part of myself started to come.
Well on her way into her second year of sobriety, Liza still finds solace in journaling, going to meetings, going on walks, and her music.
Some days are completely unmanageable, and some days are, there's nothing but suicidal ideation. You know, it's hard to know when those symptoms are going to flare up, but you learn tools to deal with them as they come. But I think that'll forever be a part of me and my music, for sure.
Forgot which day my dream was going. I wouldn't love you then.
For KFAI, I'm Sheila Regan.
On a recent 51% show, number 1597, we featured an interview with Fran Schulberg, executive producer at Climate Music Project, a San Francisco-based organization that links musicians with scientists to produce songs about climate change. Now we'll hear from a composer and a scientist who work together on a climate music piece that interprets sea level rise data. The duo discussed the collaborative process of composing the song entitled What If We with 51%'s Elizabeth Lojudis.
Wendy Loomis and Allison Markline are collaborators on an unusual project intended to inspire action on climate change. Wendy, an accomplished musician and composer, and Allison, an ecologist and climate researcher at University of California, who also happens to be a classically trained musician, worked with Wendy's band Copus to produce a song entitled What If We? The piece sonically interprets sea level rise projections and uses a blend of music, voice, and data to convey a message of hope. Wendy describes the collaborative process of writing What If We.
It started out in meetings. I did a rough recording, and then I printed out score, and then we sat down and we went through all the parts and, of course, the development of the sonifications.
Data sonification is a process that converts data into audio files. So rather than viewing charts or tables, a listener can hear the data. Allison explains.
We had a student from the San Francisco Conservatory of Music who helped us with these sonifications. And we had data that the population affected by sea level rise and the land area affected by sea level rise. And we had this for the two different scenarios, the business as usual scenario where we don't change any behaviors, and then a more hopeful scenario where there is climate mitigation action taken. And then we also use data on the sea level height throughout the piece.
And then later, once that all starts to gel, then Allison and whomever would come to a Copus rehearsal and we would perform it and play it, and then we would talk about it.
The process of turning data into music is not without challenges. A particularly tricky section of the score involved manipulating the volume of instruments, with the drums getting incrementally louder, eventually drowning out the bass.
It became interesting thing to try to describe to musicians, because they're very good musicians, but from a scientific point, it had to be like, it has to be 70% louder and then 83%. And so the band later was sort of kidding about that. Like, am I 83% louder now? Or so those things of communication between musicians and scientists became very fascinating. Just how we're going to make this all work. And I think also, Allison, because you are also a musician, that helps a lot, because then you have someone who can explain from both sides. So that's like somebody who's a translator, can speak both languages. It's very helpful.
Yeah, and it was interesting because I'm used to talking about science and scientific terms. So it's a really fun little puzzle for me to figure out how to explain science in musical terms.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, the first meeting when they were talking about various things and specifically sea level change, and I started writing the piece then, just sitting there, because I heard the chorus of it in my head while we were all sitting around the table. So I already knew that it was a destiny. The concept that I had initially was to go from the worst case scenario and then ask the question, if we make changes, how will it end up?
The data sonification has the same chord progressions as what Wendy and her band are playing, and it just increases the distortion and reverberation to show increases in the population and land area affected by sea level rise.
The music at the beginning is more intense and is more driven. There's a section I wanted to have where there would be a simulated newscast from the future, and we picked 2045, and we had sound bites that were from different parts of the world about how climate change in the worst case scenario was happening and what was affecting and what would be underwater and various things.
September 15th, 2045. The Arctic Ocean is ice-free for the first time.
September 15th, 2045. The Marshall Islands are now almost completely swallowed by the Pacific Ocean.
September 15th, 2045. In the UK, the Houses of Parliament and Westminster Abbey are both flooded.
The newscast headlines from the year 2045 were primarily taken from references within the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change special report. And we took these scientific predictions of the environment from the year 2045 and converted those, basically translated that into different news headlines.
There is a conflict between the bass instrument played by Patrick Mahan and the drums played by LaVon Washington. And it was the conflict of the sea rising up over the land. So the bass represented the land, and then the drum set represented the water. And so you'll hear the drum solo rising up over the top of the bass. Within the piece, you can feel the difference. I mean, the first half, the sounds are phased more and much choppier or more intense. And in the second half, they're much sweeter and smoother. And so you can feel that difference in the two halves, so that the listener, whether you know anything about the situation and the data, you will feel the intensity and the difference.
From a scientific point of view, the point is to notice the difference in the two halves of the piece, the first half and the second half, and that to hear how different the world could be with the action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. change. And then the innocent question, what if we, was the idea of having young singers, beautiful, optimistic, clear voices singing, because the youth around the world that are making very bold statements now, as we see, that are not going to accept the situation as normal and that want changes in their lifetime. Then the second half of the music, I did a piano part that was a gospel kind of bass thing, more major chords, so that it would be a more positive viewpoint of the world.
Eagle leaves fire in her wake. Tiger's life is at stake.
The spoken word part is also the ability of humanity to affect change. We are capable of that. We are capable of taking situations and figuring out how to not go all the way down the bottom. I wanted the piece to have a positive ending that allowed people to think, okay, it's not just all going to be doomed, that there are some things that we can do right now to make change.
For 51%, I'm Elizabeth Lo Judas.
The song What If We premiered in Washington, D.C. To learn more about climate music, you can listen to our interview with executive producer Fran Schulberg on show number 1597. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1604.